From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. For the rest of this hour, the tastes of summer. What would summertime be without sweet corn or watermelon or a nice juicy peach? We all know what tastes good, so why is it those great flavors seem harder and harder to come by? Too often a trip to the supermarket means a dry, mealy peach or a watermelon that tastes like water and a strawberries that look great but taste like cardboard. What happened? Well, my next guest has some ideas and some suggestions for rediscovering some of those great food experiences. Russ Parsons is the food and wine columnist for the Los Angeles Times. His new book is called How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. He joins us from the studios of NPR West. Welcome to the program, Mr. Parsons.
Thanks for having me on, Joe.
So, Russ Parsons, how did we get here? So I want to start with my own little anecdote here. You know, I grew up in New York City, and I didn't like vegetables. And then my parents took me when I was, I guess I was a teenager, to France. And I ate raw carrots and raw cruciferous vegetables. They must have been green peppers or something. Anyway, and I suddenly, these are great. These are fantastic. These taste wonderful. And so it was as if I'd never tasted them before. So was it just being dazzled by being in a foreign country, or is there really a difference between the produce that Americans have gotten to accept and what happens elsewhere?
Well, I think there was a big difference, especially when we were kids. I think now more and more people are finding that kind of experience just by going to their neighborhood farmer's market, or to, you know, even good produce departments in supermarkets are having much better luck. But, you know, when the way this whole thing started, it's the law of unintended consequences again, because what happened was that a system was built to make sure that everybody had plenty of good, inexpensive fruits and vegetables, which we do. I mean, malnutrition is no longer nearly the problem it was. Obesity is a problem now. And lack of flavor became a huge problem. And it's all built into the system, because the system, in the old days in the United States, every major city was surrounded by a farm belt. And that farm belt supplied the fruits and vegetables that the people in the city ate. Well, around the turn of the century, a couple things happened. Most of it was transportation related. You know, there was the railroad that crossed the United States. There was the opening up of California's Central Valley. There was the invention of the refrigerated rail car. You know, one of the great overlooked inventions of all time, because it allowed produce to be shipped from California back to New York. At the same time, local transportation in the urban areas was allowing people to get outside of the urban centers and to develop the suburbs. And suburbs, you know, then as now, usually end up on farmland. So the farmers had to go someplace. California, the eastern slopes of Oregon and Washington turned out to be perfect places to grow fruits and vegetables. All of that kind of change, there are macro changes and there are micro changes, they required a new system of produce distribution to be put into place. And that system of produce distribution over the period of 50 years kind of resulted in everybody playing the cards as safely as they could and picking things earlier and earlier, choosing varieties that would ship better over varieties that tasted better, and we ended up with what was all too often pretty undistinguished fruits and vegetables. Hmm. What's happened now, though, and that I'm really excited about in the last 30 years, is the impact that farmers' markets have had on the produce distribution. Because under the old system, there was no way for a farmer to get any kind of financial incentive for growing great fruits and vegetables. You know, if you grew peaches that made a grown man cry, and your neighbor next to you pumped his orchards full of water and picked as much as he could, he got more money than you did, because there wasn't kind of the flavor disincentive bonus.
Yeah, financial disincentive for coming up with a good tasting peach that you didn't have a lot of.
Right, because all the decisions many of the decisions that lead into good tasting peaches means smaller yields.
Yeah,
and so with farmers markets, that kind of turned that all the way around, because a farmer could say, "Taste this. Now, do you think that that's worth more than a supermarket peach?"
Yeah.
The thing that's really happened since then, though, is that that ethos has kind of created a second commodity stream for produce, where there are specialty produce distributors all over the country now who are selecting local or high quality things and putting them in restaurants and supermarkets.
And charging a premium for them, I presume.
I would hope so.
Yeah. We're talking with Russ Parsons about his new book, How to Pick a Peach, and we'd certainly like to hear about you and your fruit experiences or produce of any description. We're very open-minded here today. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. I mean, I guess the question is, and you refer to it in the book, in a way, we consumers were complicit with this because we said, "Yeah, okay, we'll buy strawberries year round, even though they don't grow year round." And so we wound up having to take stuff that was produced with the intention of having it stick around for a long time.
Well, I think a lot of times, you know, we want what we want, and we want it now, and you know. Usually we want it cheap.
That was cognitive dissonance. We just finished talking about that.
And it doesn't matter. You know, I mean, the original strawberry was a 6-week crop. And so in order to have strawberries year-round, I mean, California produces strawberries 11 months out of the year now. In order to produce that, because, I mean, you know, people in New York hotels want to have sliced strawberries in January when they're eating their breakfast. There was a market there, and so agriculture evolved to supply that market.
Right. Let me ask you another question. I mean, in terms, let's focus on the peach for a minute. Now, you hinted that growing techniques affect the way the peach is produced, and I was just working with a producer who said she had a job in Israel where they were making peaches of rubbing the peach plant so that it would what's the word I'm looking for?
Pollinate?
Pollinate, yes, more effectively. And she still has the blisters from it, she said. But the idea was to reduce the yield so you'd only get the very best peaches. Can you take the same fruit and ruin it, or is it different varieties that are chosen for specific qualities?
No, you know, in fact, that's one of the things I think people are still a little naive about, because you have to remember that produce, fruits and vegetables, they're grown, they're not manufactured. And so when you're buying a variety, you know, if you're buying a great Alberta peach, it's not the same thing as buying a Lincoln. You know, a good farmer can take a mediocre variety and grow good fruit. Mm-hmm. A bad farmer can take a great variety and grow mediocre fruit. So what you need to look for is, first of all, you need to follow the farmer, and then you need to hope that farmer picks a great variety. Because when you get those two things in sequence, that's when you get that kind of, you know, that peach that makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck. And it's an expensive proposition because what they have to do, a lot of the steps that they have to take in order to get great fruits and vegetables are things that cost money, starting with really rigorous thinning on the tree, so that there's, you know, they may lose half of the crop in the spring, so that the fruit that is left gets the concentration of the tree's vigor, for want of a better word,
right.
Then, you know, letting the fruit hang on the tree longer so that it becomes more and more mature at the same time that it's beginning to ripen. At that stage, the fruit's becoming more tender, more fragile, and all kinds of things can happen to it. From, you know, I mean, the obvious disasters like a summer hailstorm to, you know, just like naughty birds. I mean, how many times if you've ever had a tree in your backyard, you know, you lose a certain percentage of your crop to the birds, and that happens in farms as well.
I don't think we should anthropomorphize here and describe birds as naughty, but never mind. Let's take a call now and go to Jennifer. And I take it, Jennifer, is that Norman, Oklahoma?
Yes.
Okay, Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a fascinating discussion for me because my husband is originally from the Middle East. And he considers himself to be a fruit connoisseur. he has actually been approached in the grocery store, and people ask him, how do you choose your fruit? Because it's very clear to people that he's very serious.
He's
about
discerning.
How he selects his fruit. Mm-hmm. You know, in his country, when we've been there, we've been blown away by the quality of the fruits and vegetables we've had there. Although in recent years, I would say that some kind of genetic engineering or whatever has actually crept into that country, and suddenly we're getting tomatoes the size of our heads and things that we never used to see before. But my husband's rule of thumb that he always tells people is that if you cannot smell the fruit, it's probably not worth buying. So if you, you know, if you put your nose up to it and there's no apple smell or orange smell wafting out of it, then it's probably not worth buying. And actually, the fruits he likes to buy the best are the ones that you can actually smell from about 15 feet away. It's very interesting, and I don't know if you know, this is going to be a worldwide phenomenon or not, but I hope that we can continue to at least travel abroad and get some excellent fruits and vegetables, even when we have a difficult time finding them here.
Jennifer, thanks for that call. What about that? Is the nose reliable?
The nose is 9 times out of 10. Probably 9 times out of 10. That's one of the great, great indicators. There are two basic things. One of them is the perfume. Because remember, fruits are the fruits exist to carry seeds. And the farther from the tree the seed is carried, you know, so fruit, the fruit that surrounds the seed is delicious, so that it will be eaten and the seed will be carried far away. And one of the ways that attracts is through the perfume. Another really great tip, and I think that people don't focus on enough, is, you know, pick this stuff up. If fruit that's heavier for its size is always going to be better, because one of the things that happens after fruit's picked is it starts giving up moisture. And as it gives up moisture, the fruit becomes lighter and lighter. Now, there are some things that don't, where smelling doesn't work. You know, for example, with melons, if you've got a netted melon, like a cantaloupe or a musk melon, I mean, those things, when they are ripe, the perfume is just like, it'll knock you over from 10 feet away. But a honeydew melon, there's no smell whatsoever.
Yeah.
And what's funny is that the Latin name for the family of the honeydew melon is inodorous. Specifically because there is no smell.
Well, don't I have to ask? Well, wait just a second, and I'll say we're talking with Russ Parsons. He's the food and wine columnist at the Los Angeles Times about his new book, How to Pick a Peach. I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Okay, so we just came back to honeydew. How do you do a honeydew when there's no smell?
That sounds like a song, doesn't it? Yeah. How do you do a honeydew? Maybe from the 20s or something.
Honey,
like that.
Let's do the honeydew.
Yeah, do the honeydew.
Okay.
So honeydews are tough. There's a couple things that you can look for with a honeydew. One of them is the quality of the color. Instead of being kind of a hard, bright color, the color should be rich and creamy. Another thing is touch. When you feel the rind of a honeydew, it should be, I don't know how to describe that actually. It's kind of velour instead of like marble. There's a slight rub to it instead of being hard and slick. The third thing that you can check with the honeydew is every melon, when it's grown, there's a little pale spot on one side of the melon. The French call it the couche, and that's where the melon rested when it was on the ground. Check the color of that, because if it's bright white, that the melon's underripe. It should be getting creamy, going to golden. Those are the best ways. The absolute, you know, the honeydew melon that's going to completely knock you over all summer, if you find them that have where the surface is sticky, or if you find them where there are little brown speckles on the surface, those are going to be amazing, because the honeydew is, when it gets really ripe and it's really sweet, the sugar starts to bleed through the rind. Now, the complication is that produce managers usually think that that's a flaw, and so they'll wash it all off.
There you go.
But if you can, if that's there, man, you've got a great melon.
All right. Well, that's something to think about. Okay, let's talk to Steve in Madison, Wisconsin. Steve, welcome to Science Friday.
Yeah, Mr. Parsons, you stole my thunder. We're involved with organic orchards and gardens here in Wisconsin, and I was going to say look for the blemishes, the imperfections, and above all, the sign of a worm, which is a sure sign of a good organic fruit, and, of course, the smell. But, Mr. Palka, I wanted to ask, why do we never hear, speaking of the last segment, cognitive dissonance, I would say 9/11 is about the biggest example of mass psychotic cognitive dissonance. And why doesn't Science Friday ever show films of those buildings exploding due to planted explosives, right, indicating an inside job?
That's an interesting question, Steve, but we don't show films on Science Friday primarily because this is a radio program, and that would be a little awkward. But I do like the idea of the fruit. And I'm not quite sure why the blemishes. He mentioned blemishes are a good thing, Russ Parsons.
Well, you know, I think that blemishes are not necessarily a good thing, but the absence of blemishes aren't necessarily a good thing either.
Mm-hmm.
You can't believe the amount of work that goes into commercial agriculture trying to produce fruit that looks beautiful. If half of that energy was directed towards producing fruit that had great flavor, we wouldn't be having this discussion right now.
So, you know, your book talks about the fact that most of the fruit in America is grown in California. I mean, what does that do?
More than half.
More than half. What does that do to people on the East Coast such as us? I mean, do we just have to yearn, or do we have to pay, you know, airfare for a plum or something like that? Or can we really hope to get good fruit over here?
No, you can get grapefruit over there. One of the problems on the East Coast is you have to recognize that it's more difficult to grow fruit on the East Coast, which is why it moved to the West Coast. On the West Coast, our summers are really hot and they're really, really dry. On the East Coast, the summers may be really hot, but they're really humid. And that humidity encourages all kinds of problems. But you can get great fruit if you just have to work a little harder for it. And by going to the farmer's market, by tasting, by shopping around, you need to really engage all of your senses. I mean, we're really lucky out here. I don't want to open up the door for any more Californians.
No.
I also don't want to imply that everything that's grown commercially in California is bad. Because if you know what you're doing, you know, if the first step is just paying attention to what you're shopping for instead of picking things up as if they were tube socks, you know.
I'm good at tube socks, but I'm not quite as good at fruit. Hey, Russ Parsons, we've run out of time. I'm sorry. Thanks very much for joining us today. Maybe if people can't pick peach, they can pick tube socks.
Possible.
Thanks for having me on. How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. Our Kimberly Jones is our technical director, and our audio engineer is Flawn Williams. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarian Key Molesky. You can email us if you have a comment. The address is scifry@npr.org. Check out sciencefriday.com for more information and links to today's program. You can listen to past editions of Science Friday online or take them with you as a podcast. And check out Science Friday's Kids Connection, free curriculum materials for teaching science using Science Friday. For NPR News in Washington, I'm Joe Palca.